afternoon. Sorry for the delay there. Nice to see everybody. Shelby says hi. She volunteered to watch our grandchildren so that Tara could make a trip to see some friends in Tennessee. And the oldest ever, they're both redheads, but the boy got sick yesterday. He had a fever all night too. So he seems to be better today, but not better enough that you want to take him anywhere or expose him to anybody else. We don't know what it was he had. I have talked about Mesopotamian religion more than once, and some people might say, well, why do we even care? Who cares about Mesopotamian religion? Well, I care, and here's why. Because it was a religion of Abraham and his family. It says that his father, that they were all idolaters before he was called. And it's also, with some variations, depending on where exactly you were, it was the religion, or very close to the religion, of all the peoples that surrounded Israel during their existence. So it's the dominant culture, if you want to put it that way, of the world that the Bible was written in and that the Bible was written about. And the more we understand about that culture, I think the more sense the Bible makes. That's just my way of looking at it. If you relate to that, you'll enjoy the sermon. If you don't relate to it, I apologize. But those are my interests. I have, as you know, had an ongoing interest for the last 6 years or so, more so than ever before, in understanding the background to the Scripture, understanding the world the Scripture was written in, and I've shared some of what I've learned with you, and I enjoy doing that. And so if we understand the Mesopotamian world, you know, Babylon, that area, Iraq, where it is now, if we understand that world several millennia ago, back in the first and second millennium B.C., we'll understand more about the Hebrew Bible. And today, what I want to do is begin. Actually, it's going to take 2 weeks. I speak again 2 weeks from now, so we'll finish up. And today's going to be a lot of background, a lot of information, and the application will be more in the second one. So you have to come to hear the second one or listen to it online to hear more of what, how this has an impact on your life and on my life, and on, you know, what it should mean to Christians. So today we're going to take a look not just at Mesopotamian religion in general, but at their temples and their gods, and the gods who were seen to dwell, actually literally dwell, in the temples. And I will present one view. There's more than one view. I will focus on one view that makes sense to me. But it's important to remember whenever we do things like this that you talk to lots of different scholars, and they will not always agree on everything, and that's the case here as well. This presentation I'm going to give you, ideas that I'm going to share with you make a lot of sense to me. They're consistent with the Scripture, so it works, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the only explanation. Sometimes things can have more than one, there can be more than one thing going on, and we'll see that as we go through the sermon. In Mesopotamia, in that whole culture, and when you think about, I'm going to mention this later, but when you get, if you want to get an idea of what kind of a culture Babylon was, and I don't mean the details about it right now, but just how pervasive it was. If any of you are, you know, up on your geography and world news and so forth, just imagine American culture now. American culture is all over the entire world. Some areas more than others, but it's everywhere. And that's the way the Mesopotamian, if I can use that term, the Mesopotamian culture was in the time the Bible was written. It was pervasive. It was everywhere. Everybody understood it. It was the backdrop to everything. You could agree with it, disagree with it, but it was there, just like American culture is. In Mesopotamia, the temple, and they had many temples, the temple was not viewed as just a place where you could go and take a sacrifice or go and worship. It was seen as the place where the God lived. It wasn't where a god lived somewhere else, and you could go there and honor that god. The god lived there. And as I've mentioned before, I say these things when I teach at camps with young people as well, it's important to understand the difference between the God of Abraham and the gods of the world. So they were those gods, the gods of the world, the gods of Mesopotamia, they were local. They were limited. You know, they only handled, you know, their department was rain, or their department was wheat, or their department, you know, they had specific responsibilities and specific locales where they had power, or were supposed to have power. Yahweh, the God that called Abraham, is very different. He says, I want you to take a trip that's going to take you months, and I'm going to be your God down there. I'm God here, and I'm God there. That's revolutionary. We just read right over that, and it doesn't sink in sometimes. That's revolutionary in that culture. How can a God that's a God here also be a God down there in Canaan? That's ridiculous. It's not ridiculous. We as Christians understand it's not ridiculous, but to them it was. But they viewed the temple as a house of God. Now, we kind of, you know, in Israel they did the same thing in a way. There's a difference. But the temple was viewed as the actual house. The God took up residence in the temple. He was embodied by the cult statue. That's the term. And cult, by cult, we don't mean some weird religion. Cult just means the actual location where the temple is and where the God, you know, the images are and the worship takes place and all the ceremonies take place. That's the cult or the cultus. And the God took up residence there. And there were various rituals that made this work. And from there, the God could have his influence over the land, over the people, over the community, and whatever was needed. The cult statue of the deity was usually centrally located in the innermost part of the temple. Guess what? Just like the temple and the tabernacle of God. They had a holy of holies. That's where the statue of the God went. Of course, as I've mentioned before, it's important to remember, the temple and the tabernacle didn't have a statue of God in the Holy of Holies, all right? All that was in there was the Ark of the Covenant and so forth, but no statue. So, you know, again, the religion of Yahweh was very, very different in many, many ways. So the cult image was placed on a bench or on an altar in the Holy of Holies. And from there, this God could exercise rule over the land. The statue was the merging point, the meeting point between the human community, and the God who was ruling the community. What was done to the image, this is interesting, and I hadn't really understood this, what was done to the image was considered to have been done to the actual God. So I didn't write down the scriptures, but you're familiar, I believe it's probably in Judges. You know, was it Dagon, the God that fell, the fish God that fell over? Remember that a couple times? All right. We would read that and say, oh, you know, the statue fell over. But to the Philistines, that happened to their God, literally. It means that their God had taken some, well, we'll get into this a little bit later, but it meant to them that their God was without power because the image of the God had fallen over. So, this whole thing is about image of God. That's the point. I haven't gotten to the SPS yet. I'm going to be way into the sermon before I get to the SPS because it's a 2-week sermon. So I haven't really told you why I'm talking about this yet. But it's interesting. And I think I'm going to read a quote later that shows that these people viewed what happened to their image as something that literally happened to their God. And so if the image was incapacitated in some way, their God was incapacitated. And it was a sign of that. And so in these story there in Judges shows that to the Philistines, their God was incapacitated for a period of time until that God could be repaired. We'll get into that in a minute or a few minutes. The Mesopotamians actually believed that the God was, or the deity, was present in the statue. And I'll say here with one scholar, I'm going to quote here, one scholar states that the significance of the statue lay in the fact that this was a place where in a unique, though not exclusive way, the deity manifested himself or herself and was present. And, I won't say anything else yet, I'll keep reading. Another says that the cult statue should not be viewed as a sort of vessel into which the deity poured its specific divine content, nor as a body with a God incarnate in it. Rather, the material elements of the cult statue were somehow transformed or transubstantiated to become the God it represented. It was not as though the cult statue in becoming God ceased to be the cult image. The cult statue simultaneously, at the same time, was and was not God. And your mind's just going, huh, why should I care about this? And this doesn't make sense. That might appear or seem to be contradictory. How can it be and not be at the same time? Christians in general don't have a leg to stand, I don't think, because Christians in general believe in the Trinity, where things are and aren't at the same time. A certain big chunk of Christianity believes in transubstantiation of the host during the Eucharist, where this physical substance is and is not the body of Christ at the same time. So we don't have anything. We shouldn't be too critical of them as modern-day Christians, because we have the same kinds of beliefs in our own societies. But to the ancient Near Eastern mind, back in those days, it didn't seem incongruous at all for the God to be there, literally, and to be somewhere else at the same time. That wasn't a problem. You know, those kinds of mysteries, they didn't think like Plato or Socrates. They didn't have a Greek Western mindset. We didn't live there, and we can't talk to them, but from the way they acted, what they did, and what they wrote, they didn't think the way we think today. That's what scholars have determined. I totally agree with that. Everything I've seen and read supports that, and I think the Bible supports that. You don't want to read the Bible as a Greek too much. You try when you read the Bible to get back into the sandals of the people who wrote it, and they weren't Greeks. At least in the Hebrew Bible, they weren't. And even the ones who wrote in the New Testament, they might have written in Greek, some of them, but they weren't Greek. They just lived in a Greek society. They were Jewish and lived in Palestine. Okay, got off my subject there. Here's a quote for a story. It's called The Era Epic. The statue of the Babylonian god Marduk, and you've heard of Marduk, I'm sure, I've mentioned him before, became covered with soot, and his clothing became dilapidated. And this was considered not the fate of the statue alone, but of Marduk himself. The Era Epic makes it clear that if the statue's appearance corrupts, then the deity can abandon his image. Era reassures Marduk that he will rule in his stead while Marduk leaves while his statue is being restored. This is the way the story reads, okay? This is one of Babylonian story. So when the statue becomes defiled in some way, the god is viewed to have to leave and abandon the statue and come back after a repair. Okay, that's the system. There's another story which is pretty much says the same thing. What were these statues like? How were they constructed? Well, let's turn to Jeremiah 10. Now, if you've been around long enough like me, you've heard people say in our culture and history that this is talking about a Christmas tree. It is not. If you read all the verses and you just read it in context, it's obvious that it's not talking about that. Jeremiah 10 and verse 1. Now, I work in construction, so these verses mean something to me. I can learn and visualize very clearly what's going on here, and I'm sure you can too. Verse 1, hear the word which the Eternal, or the Lord Yahweh, speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus says the Lord, do not learn the way of the nations. Do not be terrified by the signs of the heavens, although the nations are terrified by them, for the customs of the people are a delusion. I'm reading from the New American Standard today. Because it is wood cut from the forest, the work of the hands of a craftsman with a cutting tool. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers so it won't totter. Like a scarecrow in a cucumber field they are. They cannot speak. They must be carried because they can't walk. Don't fear them, for they can do no harm, nor can they do any good. There is none like you, O Lord. You are great, and great is your name and might. Who would not fear you, O King of the nations? Indeed, it is your due. For among the wise men of the nations and in all their kingdoms, there is none like you. But they are altogether stupid and foolish. In their discipline of delusion, their idol is wood. Beaten silver is brought from Tarshish and gold from Uphaz, and work of a craftsman in the hands of a goldsmith. Violet and purple are their clothing. They are all the work of skilled men. But the Lord is the true God. He is the living God and the everlasting King. At his wrath, the earth quakes, and the nations cannot endure his indignation. Thus you shall say to them, the gods that did not make the heavens and the earth will perish from the earth and from under the heavens. I want you to take note of that. The gods that did not make the heavens and the earth will perish from the earth. Verse 12 says, it is he who made the earth by his power, who established the world by his wisdom. By his understanding, he has stretched out the heavens. When he utters his voice, there is a tumult of waters in the heavens. And he causes the clouds to ascend from the end of the earth, and he makes lightning for the rain, and he brings out the wind from his storehouses. Every man is stupid, devoid of knowledge. Every goldsmith is put to shame by his idols, for his molten images are deceitful. There's no breath in them. Take note of that. No breath in them. They are worthless, a work of mockery. In the time of their punishment, they will perish. It's talking about idols, totems, totem poles, things that are put up on stands. They're cut down from the forest, hewed out of wood, shaped, and covered with gold. That's the way they were made. That's the way they were made in Babylon. Why is that interesting to me? Well, it's interesting to me. It's just interesting because of the construction, but also because scholars note that there are none. If you want to find, you can go and see Egyptian stone images, you can see Babylonian stone images, but you don't see the cultic statues that were put in the Holy of Holies. The only place you can see them is pictures on walls. You don't actually find them. And why don't you find them? Why? They're wood. If they were made of something more durable, they would stay. And here in Jeremiah says, well, you know, they're wood. They're wood and they're covered with gold. So people, you know, over time, I'm sure they steal the gold and the wood just rots. So we don't find any today because that's how they were constructed, interestingly enough. There are plenty of images in the ancient world, stone images, other, you know, metal images, whatever. You can see them in museums, but they aren't the cultic images that were in the Holy of Holies in their temples. We don't find them today, at least not Mesopotamian ones. So I thought that was interesting. Jeremiah hits the nail right on the head, said they perish. In the time of their punishment, they're going to perish. You know, they're just not going to last. They're made of wood. So that's been proven true. Now, after one of these was built, if I'm the carpenter, and I've gone to great pains, I'm terrible at that. I'm not an artist. On the road that goes to Fairfield near where I live, there's a barbecue place right on the corner that opens in the summer. And behind them, somebody, I guess he rents a little space there, or his friends or whatever, and he, with a chainsaw, makes all kinds of statues, carvings. Look like idols. They're not covered with gold, though. You know, there could be a man standing or an eagle or a bear or whatever, you know, those kinds of things. If I could do that, what is the process after I've done that and after I've had a goldsmith cover it with gold or silver? What was the process that that statue went through to become divine? That was interesting. I didn't know anything about this, just read it recently. This merging of human and divine space was achieved through a mouth cleansing, which is called mispi, and a mouth opening ritual, mouth washing and mouth opening. That's the names they've given these rituals. They found details of these rituals in several documents from the 9th century B.C. And bits and pieces of it from other times too. These rites of these rites were performed on the statue to make it into an image that properly represented the deity. The rites of purification had to be performed on the cult statue before it could take up residence in the Holy of Holies. A stone tablet dating from the 9th century B.C. Tells of one such fashioning of a new cult statue and its ritual dedication. It claims that the image of Samas, the great lord, was prepared by the king through the skill of the various gods. The king washed the statue's mouth with rites of purification before Samas in the temple of Akar Sanjina or something like that. Then the statue took up the dwelling. In order for the statue to take up its dwelling in the Holy of Holies, not only did its mouth had to be washed, but it had to be opened through another ritual. The washing of the mouth purified the cult image from any human contamination, and the opening of the mouth enabled the statue to do things like eat and drink and hear, you know, listen, and so forth, and smell incense that's offered to it. So you had to, in a way, enliven this image, right? Give it some kind of life. That was the symbolism there. And the washing had to do with purifying it from the taint of, you know, somebody like me who would have constructed this thing so that they could say it is only divine. At least symbolically, I had nothing to do with it. It was just the gods working with me and helping me to do a good job. That's the way they wrote about it. You wanted to remove the traces of human origins so that it had a divine origin. So we have the construction, or creation if you want to say, of an inanimate object, which becomes the image of deity by a special ceremony involving the mouth. After that, the statue was placed in the temple to do the job of ruling the area. Now, having said all that, does that at all sound familiar? In Genesis 2 and verse 7, you don't need to turn there because you know it. It says, "The Lord God formed man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being." It's very similar to the way it's written. It's a very similar idea to what the Babylonians did to their idols. What did God do after that? In verse 8, it says, "The Lord God planted a garden toward the east in Eden where he placed the man whom he had formed." And in verse 15 also says, "The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and keep it." So God put man, he created man, he gives him life, breath, and he puts him in a garden, which is temple imagery as well. And there's a lot of temple imagery in the Old Testament and a lot of it in Genesis, I believe, and lots of people do. And he put him there to do a job, to dress it and keep it, just like, you know, just like the imitation, if you want to call it that, that the Babylonians did. They put an idol in their temple to do a job, to rule. So God said, it says he put man in the garden. He breathed into him the breath of life, and he put him in a garden, and he gave him a job to do, to dress it and keep it. But there's more than that. And we read, if you read the other account in Genesis 1, it says God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness." And then what's it say? "And let them rule. Let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female. And God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So God put man on earth not for our own sakes only, but he gave us a job to do. Actually, we were to rule the rest of the creation. And, of course, man is the crowning accomplishment, you say. You know, it's on the sixth day. It's the last day before the Sabbath. You know, all the other things are made, and then God makes man to take care of everything else. Gives him that job. And he tells him to rule. Does he rule? Does it say just rule the garden? No. It says rule, rule over all this stuff that was made, all these things that were made. It's rule of the earth. So what's going on here, if you want to look at it this way, and I think it's a reasonable way to look at it, is that God has put man on the earth and told him to rule. And from the garden, that was the intention anyway, from the garden, man could rule, but man could also spread this peace, this joy, this happiness, this perfection in a way that God had created. He says, "Be fruitful and multiply." So God understood that this was going to spread, and he wanted it to spread, what, all over the earth. He wanted his way to spread all of the earth, and his agents for doing that were men, people like you and me. Now, I have talked before also about the polemical style. Polemical meaning, you know, having a point to make. You're writing a history, okay, but getting your digs in when it's time, you know, when you want to get a dig in. And I've told you that Exodus does that in the beginning. I've told you that Genesis does it in the beginning. And I'm revisiting that theme again today. That Genesis is written in the way it's written, one of the reasons it's written that way, is to get the digs in at the Babylonian culture, or the Mesopotamian culture. You know, the writers, the different, you know, there's different books that make up, you know, these are the generations, these are the, you know, there's Genesis is made up of, I don't know, four or five, maybe more, different, you know, collection of writings. And whoever wrote those, and then whoever edited, put it together, Moses was involved in there at some point. All this was done for a reason, to make some points. And one of the points is to show a huge contrast between the God of Abraham, Yahweh, and the typical gods of the Mesopotamian world. And in this particular instance, the reason I'm going through all this, I'm giving you a lot of background, I believe that the phraseology here, that creating, you know, it says, "Let us make man in our image and in our likeness." That making man in his own image is one of the is a way of saying it, a way of writing it, to get in a definite dig at Mesopotamian culture. So, you know, you make your, like Jeremiah says, you make your idols. You make these wooden things. You cover them with gold. You cover them with silver. God made something that breathes on its own and walks around on its own. You know, us, men. We are created in his image. We are placed in the garden. And we have the responsibility of ruling as agents of God over the earth. So now I'm getting to the point. I'll give you the SPS, tell you where I'm going. Being created in the image of God has a lot of meaning. It has an awful lot of meaning. At the time the Bible was written, it wasn't just a way of saying man was created to look like God, or man even was just created to have a relationship with God. Even if those things are true, it meant a lot more. Image of God meant a lot more to someone in the ancient Near East. So we'll begin to explore that topic today. We'll continue next time, and before we're through, we'll see how this actually ties the whole Bible together, because you will see, and I won't turn there today, but we'll see when we get into the New Testament that the writer of Hebrews, that Paul, that others write about the being created in the image of God and who was created in the image of God and how it's all worked out, and sometimes it didn't work out, and what's being done to make it right. That's what the whole story of the Bible is, actually. And I've encouraged you, I'll keep doing it. It's like beating. I know I beat the same drum sometimes, but it's good to read the Bible as a whole, because the story starts at the beginning, ends at the end, and the whole thing has a theme. It's not just pick a little here, pick a little there. It has a theme going all the way through. And that one of those, the theme, maybe the biggest theme is that God created things that were very good, they became bad, and the rest of the Bible is about how God's going to make it right. And that's the process that we're involved in, that we're caught up in. And it's a wonderful thing to be involved in. And one of the ways we can tie all that together is to look at how the image of God is treated in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Scriptures, and in the New Testament, and see that it all ties together and makes the theme is complete as you go all the way through. And it's not complete yet. It's not right yet. We believe in a future, right? We have the fall festivals coming up, when we look to the future and things that are yet to be fulfilled. And that's when we really look to how things are going to be made right for the whole world. We understand through Passover, of course, and Pentecost, that for those that are called now, citizens. I was going to mention that in the sermon. I don't have it in my notes, but we're citizens of the kingdom now. But the whole world's going to be part of that kingdom at some point, and that's what we look forward to with the fall festivals. So it's a wonderful subject, I think, and I just want to give you some ammunition to look at it from a slightly different way, a slightly different perspective in these two sermons. And when we get next week, I probably won't touch on it this week, but it's not just some theoretical head knowledge. I'll go into, what difference does it make? All right? Who cares? Well, we need to care, because being a citizen of the kingdom, being created in God's image, gives you and me definite opportunities and responsibilities, and a certain understanding of things that's available by understanding that. So maybe we're going to touch on it this week, maybe, but mostly that'll be next time, 2 weeks from now. I have to tell you up front that I haven't come up with these ideas on my own. I'm indebted to writings of J. Richard Middleton, Liberating Image, the Imago Dei, I can't speak Latin, in Genesis 1, and also Rebecca Devine, a research paper that she did that are on this subject. You may be interested in the words themselves. The word in Hebrew for image and likeness. Most people that understand Hebrew will say you can't prove necessarily anything. A lot of, especially in Hebrew, words have a lot of different meanings, and you got to look at them in their context. But the word salam, however you say that has to do with image, primarily designates a three-dimensional cult statue of a false god. And they're all roundly condemned in the Old Testament. So that's pretty much how that word is used. And the other word, demut, which is the word for likeness, means looking like. It's just like it's translated, something it looks like. So you have an image and we have a likeness. The image means usually a cult statue in the Holy of Holies, three-dimensional thing, not a picture. And the other word has to do with something that looks like something else in appearance or form. Now, if you were to do your own research on being created in God's image, you will see that there are three main ways of looking at that. And I'm not going to suggest that any of them are wrong or right. They may be complementary. There's, I think, truth in all of them. But there are three views, and we will focus on the third one in these sermons. The first one, what does it mean to be created in God's image? And I've used all these, so I haven't specialized. I guess I'm ambivalent. They all seem to have some make sense to me, but the third one in particular will shed light, a different kind of light that I haven't explored before. The first one is called the substantialist view, and that is that there's something significantly different about a man or a woman, a human being, as compared to animals. That we are created in a way that's entirely different and unique, and that's what it means to be created in the image of God. Now, I'm not going to argue with that. I think it's true that we're created in a way that's utterly unique, all right, and that we're different from the animals. I'm not so sure that that's what being created in the image of God is all about. I think it's a lot more than that. But that's one idea. You've probably thought that. I've thought that. And it's not necessarily wrong. I think it is true that we are created that way. I don't think that that's what being created in the image of God means. At least that's not all of it. The idea of why it's called a substantialist view, there's something, a substance, right? There's something about us that's different. There's another interpretation called the relational interpretation, which means that this is more from a Reformation standpoint, Luther and Calvin and others, that said that it has to do with having this relationship with God and being in ethical conformity with him, obedience, and that type of thing. That view is not very prevalent today, but it's true. We do have a relationship with God. That's true as well. I don't think it's what it means to be created in the image of God. I don't think that's what the writers of Genesis were meaning when they wrote it. The third view is more common among scholars. It's called the functional view, and this is this means that image, that word image, is as I described to you. It is a localized, visible, real, something you can touch, representation of the divine. When the clues in the Genesis, I'm quoting this here, when the clues within the Genesis text are taken together with comparative studies of the ancient Near East, they lead to what we would call a functional or even missional interpretation of the image of God. In other words, that being created in the image of God means that we have a job to do, a function to perform. All right? Just like those images, things that we would call images, those gods, those cultic gods, in the cultic statues in the temples, they had a job to do. We were created with a job to do. That's what functional means. You have a function. All right? We all have a function. Mankind has a function. And if you read it this way, the Imago Dei designates the royal office or calling of human beings as God's representatives and agents in the world, granted authorizing power to share in God's rule or administration of the earth's resources and creatures. The function of humankind is to image the invisible God in his creation. Okay, now I believe that's true also. I mean, I don't think anything's wrong with any of these three. The point is, I agree with those who would say this is the meaning of being created in God's image. We are created with a purpose and with a function, with a job to do. All right? Mankind in general, not just you or me, or not just people that are quote-unquote important. And that's interesting, too. We'll get to that in a minute. So this is the viewpoint we'll be focusing on today. Specifically, that the Imago Dei refers to humanity's office and role as God's earthly delegates, whose task on earth is analogous to that of a heavenly court. You know, so God says, let us make God in our image. Now we can say, oh, he's talking to Jesus, he's talking to the Word, talking to the angels. We don't really know. It doesn't say. But the image there, or I shouldn't use the word image in this sermon, the picture that's being painted is that there's a council. There's people in charge, or people, there's creature beings in charge, and God's having a discussion. That's at least, that's a mental picture I get. You know, it's not just God deciding on his own, he's having a discussion with someone or someones. And those individuals are responsible for how things go in heaven, or in his realm. And then he creates people to be responsible for how things go on the realm down here. So there's an analogous relationship there. They have similar purpose. And God seems to not just be, it wasn't just a matter of having his rule in the Garden of Eden, but he wanted to spread all over the earth. He said, be fruitful and multiply. He wasn't threatened by that, that the rule would spread. We sing a song. Did we sing it? The rule will go spread over every house and farm. It's one of Mark Graham's hymns, I think. You know that's what we picture with the fall festival. So this, that God's rule will extend. That's what the original plan was. Got fouled up because why? Because we sin, and Adam sinned. But that's the original plan, and it's going to be achieved in the end. You remember when I spoke about the book of Exodus, a sermon I called The Rhetoric of Reversal in Exodus, that kings in the ancient Near East, and today, because I know when I go to Thailand, the picture of the king is everywhere. It's all over the country. Well, it was like that in the ancient Near East. Remember, I showed you pictures of humongous statues. One where if you were here, the one person was standing next to the shoulder of a statue, and the person was dwarfed by the shoulder. You can imagine how big this thing was and it was standing up. Well, why did they have a statue like that? Because whoever that statue was of, and I don't remember who it was supposed to be of, wants to tell those people, and wherever he built that statue, which was probably far away from where his kingdom was, but he ruled these other people, and he wanted to remind them who ruled them, and remind them where to send the taxes. Okay? Remind them who's in charge. Well, in the ancient Near East, that's the way it was. You had statues, you had images that reminded people who you were. And you extended your presence that way. Now, God doesn't extend his presence that way. He forbade images, right? No images. It's exactly the opposite. That's, you know, I get excited about this because it is a polemic. In the ancient Near East, people put statues up all over the place. So what's God say? No statues, not of me, you know. No statues of things to worship. He's the opposite. He's the opposite. He says, this culture's bad. Don't be like this. Be like this. So you go into the Holy of Holies in the temple, there's no statue. Pagans couldn't figure that out. So how does God extend his presence on earth if he doesn't put statues everywhere? He creates people and he tells them to be fruitful and multiply and, you know, go over the earth. That's how. Now, part of what I'm saying kind of makes it sound like God is a king, and he is a king, of course, in a way. He's not identified that way in the book of Genesis, but he delegates power and responsibility like a king does. It says he delegates authority of the day to the sun, the night to the moon, and authority over the rest of creation to man. So that's like a king. We got the heavenly court idea. Let us make man in our image. We have, you know, conducting a meeting of the royals, as it were. So whoever's writing this, and creation by just saying the word, right? The kings can do that. Kings can order something to happen, and it happens. So I think God is presented as a king in Genesis, even though it doesn't say God is king in those words. And I think it's very significant that, well, I'll back up. We've talked before about who is represented by these, or who represents the gods. Who is it that is viewed as being the God's buddy when we talked about the Exodus? It's the king, the Pharaoh. The king is the one who's tight with God. In the Roman Empire, the king was God himself, or a god. And that's the way it was viewed. And when a king said something, that's the way it was. We're just reading from Esther. He says, boom, you know, it's the law of the Medes and Persians. Can't even be changed. Even if he wants to change it, he can't. We'll get there another week. But that's the way kings were. They were viewed. But what do we have in Genesis? We have Adam representing all of mankind. So it's not just Adam who's created in the image of God to sit in the temple, or sit in the garden, as it were, but all mankind. This is very different, okay? And I can't stress how different it is. The kings were understood to be representatives of the God, maybe priests, but not everybody. But in the Bible, we're presented with mankind in general, all 7 billion of us being created in the image of God. That's very, very different from the way most religions look at it. Only Judaism, Christianity, and Islam tend to look at it that way. They all descended from Abraham. You remember when we talked about the Mesopotamian gods and the creation stories? Mankind's like a bother. Mankind gets in the way. Mankind created to just, you know, bring the food, bring the drinks, you know, wait on us because they're a pain. God creates man, puts him in a beautiful garden, tells him there's plenty to go around. I want you to have plenty of kids and inhabit the whole earth. It's a very different presentation of creation than what was in the Babylonian creation myths. And that's why I keep coming back to this. It's very different. Genesis is written in a polemic way to say, look, God is nothing like the gods that you see around you. Nothing at all. Very different. So God granted in creation, by creating Adam and authorizing, if you want to put it that way, or deputizing Adam and Eve and all their descendants to rule over creation, he's granting authority, delegating authority. He's giving man in general, every man, a share in his image, in the image of what we call the image of God. Now, we can, I'm going to get into this later, but I'll mention it now. I want to get into it next time. Is there? Can you think off the top of your head? Maybe this is too much too fast. If what I'm saying makes sense to you, or even if it doesn't, you think, you know, humor me and think through it. If you're created in God's image, and I'm created in God's image, and everybody's created in God's image, and we all then, by being in God's image, are representative of him. And this ties into the New Testament, right? We're all citizens, citizens of the kingdom now. So we all represent God. At least as Christians we try to. Maybe not other people. Does that have consequences? Does that have an impact in how we do things? How we do things as a church? How we do things as people? You think, I mean, if you don't have an answer for that now, we'll get to it in 2 weeks, but what's, you know, Jesus said, his disciples, you know, it's a night he's going to be betrayed, and they're arguing about who's the greatest, right? And what's he say? Anybody?
Your servant is the greatest of them all.
Your greatest is a servant. So he says, again, it's that polemical answer. It's the opposite of what everybody thinks. He said that the Lord, the Gentiles lorded over each other, that's their nature. He's talking about, in particular, I assume, the Romans, who were the Gentiles that mattered to the Jews at that time. You know, the Romans had a hierarchy. A hierarchy that carried over into what in the 4th century? Constantine, right? What did that Roman hierarchy, where did that get exported? To, well, it was in Rome, and it was over the empire, but it was a model for something else. Maybe I'm asking. This is off the subject a little bit, but who? Huh?
The church.
The church took the model of the whatever you want to call it, the beast. The church adopted that model of governing itself, and churches have ever since. I would suggest that the reformers had something going for them. I'm not justifying the reformers and all their faults. But to say that there's a priesthood of all believers, you know, that we don't really need this hierarchy with one person in charge representing God and all that kind of thing, that's a Roman idea. It's not from the Bible. And I think that the idea of that we're all created in God's image, that doesn't mean there's not authority and responsibility. I'm not trying to down that. But the idea that we have to approach God through a hierarchical structure somehow, through other people, that's not biblical. And I think when you look at it this way, it's not biblical all the way back in Genesis 1. You don't have to get to the New Testament to wonder about that. Even all the way back in Genesis 1, it's setting out a different pattern than the way the world rules itself. So that's just something to think about, chew on a little bit. But God created us not to serve, and yes, we do serve him in the sense of we worship him and we want to honor him, but not to wait on him, you know, bring him food, bring him drink. That's not the point. That's the way the Babylonians looked at it. There's a very obvious line and distinction in Genesis 1, 2, and 3, and really the rest of the book, but especially in the beginning, there's a very definite line between here's the way the Babylonians do it or the Mesopotamians do it, and here's the way God does it. Very, very different. We weren't created to be the butlers for the gods. It's very liberating. Okay? Now, you can abuse that. You know, Paul warns against, I think it's Paul, warns against using the freedom that we have for license. We don't want to do that. That's a different subject. But we do have a certain freedom. We're not, God didn't create us to enslave each other. And God is not threatened by human overpopulation. In the Babylonian myths, there's too many people, and they're too noisy, and they're too this, and they're too that. And God says, be fruitful, have lots of kids. There's plenty out there, plenty for everybody. And I think I mentioned this here before. I know I've mentioned it in studies for youth, but I think I did here. You know, in Genesis 1, did you realize that when, in Hebrew, it doesn't even name the sun and the moon? Did I mention that before? It's not there. It's this light that rules the day and light that rules the night, or something to that effect. I'm not looking at it right now. It doesn't name them. Why? Because, again, I think whoever wrote it just didn't want to give them the time of day because they were important gods. And the words for the sun and moon also are words that were used for gods at that time. So it didn't have to, or words that were close. Just like we say moon and month are close, well, their word for the god was similar to the word for the sun or the word for the moon. These religions, which now are astrology, you know, these things that focus on the stars and the sun and the moon, these are religions that start, or beliefs that started in Mesopotamia. But in Genesis, you know, God made the sun and the moon just like he made the birds and the bees. They're created, all right? We're not going to even give them the time of day. And as I told the young people when I was teaching this, I said, not only did he make them, he didn't get around to it until the fourth day. This is your chief god. Your number one god, Ra in Egypt. I don't forget what they were called. Or no, Ra, Isaac, yeah, Ra, I forget what the Mesopotamian version of it is. But that's your number one god, the sun god. Now, our God made that, and he didn't get to it till the fourth day. It's a little jab in the side. That's what he was doing, whoever wrote those words. The Akkadian word for sun god is Samas, and the Hebrew word for sun is Semes, or I can't pronounce, you know, slightly different, but... So we're not even going to go there because it's too close. We're not even going to give it a name. In the Babylonian world, they worship the sun. They worship the moon. In God's world, what is it? The moon and sun serve us by giving us light. You see, it's exactly the opposite. Stars were very, very important to the Babylonians, to the Mesopotamians. It's very, you know, as I said, that's where our astrology came from, their religions. Stars are very important. And in Genesis, it says, he made the sun, the moon, and yeah, he made the stars too. So it kind of almost doesn't give them the time of day. So there's a lot of polemic there, I think. Genesis 1, it's making the point. It's making the point very clearly that God is so different. And also, in Genesis, we get the idea that, as I mentioned before, that we are, as human beings, we are God's agents in the world. And that was on purpose. In ancient mythologies, it was the gods who accomplished everything, right? The gods did this, the gods are the heroes, the gods, blah, blah, blah. Now, I gotta get out of this and look at something else, because I don't have my Bible up here, but if you look in Genesis, which chapter is it? Maybe 5. Yeah. Genesis 5. It's got the generations of the sons of Adam, right? We've got Seth, we got different ones. And I want to skip down. Maybe this isn't the... Sorry. No, I don't want 5. I want 4. Chapter 4, verse 17. Cain built a city. Or Enoch. Enoch built a city. All right, so the first city was formed, founded by a human, not a god. See, Genesis, rather than giving honor to all these gods, it gives honor to people in a way, or maybe sometimes it's negative honor, you know, or shame, whatever. Enoch built a city. Lamech, Jubal, Zillah, there we go. Tubal Cain, forger of all implements in bronze and iron. It doesn't give the credit to a god, it gives the credit to a human being, a person. And I think there's other ones there. That'll give you an idea. The idea is that God gave man the ability, the responsibility also, and the opportunity to go out and do things. And he apparently enjoys that. He's glad to see man be creative. Although, as is the case in Genesis, is the case now, we create things and we use them for evil. That's too bad, but I think God put the creative instinct in us. It's just that we want to create, you know, atomic bombs and things like that. So it's not just a king, and it's not just, you know, some god, some supernatural. It's actual human beings that are responsible for some of the innovations in the world. That's something you're going to read in the Bible, but you're not going to read it anywhere else in those ancient texts, because the ancient texts glorified gods or maybe kings. And in fact, a lot of times when it did give the whole purpose, to just lend some more, give some more information here, the whole purpose of some of the writings was to legitimize the present king or the present kingly line. So you went and gave a history that made this kingly line sound important or whatever, or acceptable. So that's the way they were written, to glorify a king or glorify a god. I'm not saying the Bible's written to glorify men. That's wrong. That's not the point. But the Bible's willing to give credit where credit is due, which the ancient myths weren't. Also, you know, I'm not going to go spend a lot of time there, but before I guess it's right after the flood, right? God's, you know, talking about shedding blood, that he invokes, we get a death penalty. And again, it shows, in the Hebrew Bible, shows a respect for life. You know, life's in the blood, don't drink the blood, and so forth. There's a respect for life. Again, that's different than the other cultures. All right. Wrap this up here shortly. You know, there's another thing that's significant. And I hadn't noticed this before, I had to read somebody else who noticed it. You read the beginning here. You read Genesis 1, 2, 3. You read all the way through the early part of Genesis. And what's missing? There's no king other than God. Any ancient tale you're going to read, it involves king. There's kings. There's men in charge, because it's written with them in mind to give them authority somehow or another, or legitimacy in the eyes of the people. And you read the beginning of the book of Genesis, there's no king. God didn't make Adam say, all right, you're king, and all you got to rule over all your kids. He told Adam, as a representative of mankind in general, to rule over the rest of creation. He didn't give Adam the authority to rule over his brothers, his sisters, not that he had literal brothers, but you know what I mean, other men. Not even his wife, in a sense. It wasn't God's intention that we set ourselves over one another in that way. At least if it was his intention, he forgot about it at the beginning. I'm being sarcastic. I don't think he forgot about it. He just didn't desire that we would do that. And later on, the prophets make it clear. You know, Samuel says, don't have a king. You don't want a king. Guess what's going to happen if you have a king? Blah, 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 blah. It wasn't God's idea for people to set themselves up that way, or for people, you know, the whole crowd to set an individual up that way. That's not his idea of how to do it. That's man's idea. And that's significant. And I hadn't thought about it before, but you know, if it was God's idea to set up some kind of a hierarchical structure of how we're supposed to rule each other and control each other, why wouldn't he have done that at the very beginning? But it's not there. It's not there. For what it's worth, it's not there. Make of it what you will. It's interesting that there's a, you have this, you know, the world, whatever they call the world before Abraham, the primeval world, whatever you want to call that. It, you know, the Bible presents it as a world where God did not institute a monarchy. That's so different from the other accounts. You read the Babylonian accounts, you read the Sumerian accounts, the Egyptian accounts. It's always lists of kings that live forever. You know, they live, I'm exaggerating, live for a long time. King lists. That's what they wrote about because that's how they govern themselves. In Genesis, it's not that way. Make of it what you will, but it's not there. Of course, what happened? Well, what happened is we have sin. And we'll talk about that more next time. But Adam and Eve did not follow through. I'll try to whet your appetite just a little bit. They didn't fulfill the plan that God had for them. And none of us since then have, you know, we've all inherited, in a sense, that proclivity to sin, and we've all sinned and come short of the glory of God. Except for one, that's significant too, one who came in the image of God, right? Isn't that what it says in Hebrews? We'll get in there next time. Express image, or maybe it's Colossians. I'm sorry, I keep saying Hebrews, but express image, you know, exact image. This one got it right. Adam didn't get it right. We don't get it right. We try. But, you know, there is one who got it right. And that's part of the story of how God, of course, is redeeming the whole world to himself. So that's what we'll do next time. We will move on from there, from where we are, from a prehistory, if you want to put it that way, or a beginning to history that we read about in the book of Genesis that does not exalt a king, does not establish a kingly line, that shows us that man, in general, mankind, has been given agency, which is the ancient word for it, or the technical word for it. You could call it, you know, we're deputized, in a sense. We are given a portion of God's authority to rule over the earth. You know, maybe we haven't done a good job with that, but that's our job. That's our job. God doesn't need a statue to do it. He breathed life into a real person. And we have, because of Adam's sin and because of the trajectory that mankind has taken since then, God came up, already had a plan. It's from the beginning, Jesus was sacrificed, right? So there was a plan. And that plan involved our Savior, who got it right, who was perfectly the image of God, because Israel didn't get it right. We'll skip that right now, but, you know, Adam didn't get it right, Israel didn't get it right. The prophets said, you know, didn't talk about Adam, but they said Israel didn't get it right. Kings, that was a bad idea, didn't work out too well. And they prophesied Messiah. Messiah came, and now we look forward to the end of it all, when all things are made right. And what's it say? What does Paul say? God is all in all. You know, it's all going to be made right. And what God intended in the beginning, where man is the image of God, is going to actually be the case in the end. We're just in the middle of the story somewhere. So next time we'll pick up that story where we are, and we'll show how, we'll turn to the scriptures, that follow this theme, some in the Old Testament, some in the New Testament. It shows it's a continuous story. It's not like you draw a line and you got the Old Testament and it's way different than the New Testament. No, the story arc goes right on through. It's the same story. And it's not over yet. We're looking forward to the future when it will be completed. But in the end, all mankind, you know, God's wish that everybody be saved. In the end, as many who are willing will be saved and be truly recreated, resurrected, if we put it that way, into the real image of God. So we'll find out more about that next time. I'll just give you all the background this time. God's way is so very, very different than the world's way. And, you know, it's easy to maybe, you know, to look back at Babylon and say, well, it's, you know, the way the Babylonians did things, the way the Mesopotamians did things was so different from the way God did things. But what we need to do, and I don't do this nearly enough, is we need to apply that same thinking to today. The culture of the world is as bad today in many ways, maybe worse in some ways, better in others, but it's still an evil culture. It's not godly. And if somebody could give this sermon, you know, 4,000 years from now and look back at our time, they could say the same thing I'm saying about Mesopotamia and Israel. They could say the same thing about us now. It's an evil world, and we need to be separate and different from it. And we're citizens of that kingdom now. We don't have to wait. So our time to behave and act differently as representatives of that kingdom is now. And we'll talk more about that next time.